Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Aline Gorosian. Dr. Gorosian is a dual board certified physician specializing in emergency medicine and critical care. But her journey as a patient may be more interesting than her life as a physician. As she writes in her blog, A Change of Heart, on December 21st, 2018, I almost died. She required an urgent heart transplant after contracting a viral condition earlier that year that led her to discover she had familial dilated cardiomyopathy. Now, years later, recovered and back working as a physician, she advocates for organ donation, research, and charities. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Gorosian.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Your story is amazing.
Thank you.
I know you've rehashed this story so many times on so many different platforms, but for the listening audience who may not have heard the story to the fullest extent, can you recount those terrifying moments early in 2018 when you first realized that you were going through something and that it was that severe?
Yeah, of course. I can give you a little bit of a picture of what my life was like that at that time, and then kind of what happened and led to my diagnosis. So I was in residency. I was a third year emergency medicine resident at that time. And as you know, like, I was applying to fellowship. So you usually do your applications to fellowship during your third year. And I had applied. I had actually just gotten into a critical care fellowship. This was around December of 2018. And I had, you know, less than 6 months left of residency. I always tell people, I was 30 years old. Everything was going very well. I had gotten into my top choice fellowship. I was getting ready to move to New York City. Everything was really going really, really well, like academically, at work, everything. Everything was fine. And I had never really had any medical issues. But like, I actually have some pictures from that time too, where on the interview trail, I started developing kind of like a URI, or what seemed like an upper respiratory infection with a little cough. And this was around like October Halloween time is what I remember it most. And then it kind of just like lingered, didn't go away. And the cough just kept getting worse and worse. Now, it wasn't bad to the point where like I couldn't go to work or I couldn't go out. In fact, I have like pictures from going out with one of my best friends just a few days before my big hospitalization. So it was like this lingering cold, but nothing that was like really keeping me back from like doing my normal daily things. Then towards the end of December, right before Christmas, actually, of 2018, I was at work one day and things got like significantly worse. And I remember, like, I always tell the story of how I usually like to take these stairs when there's like codes in the hospital just to get some exercise in. And that particular day, I couldn't. And like one of my attendings kind of said, "You look off." And, you know, I just wasn't feeling that good. And it seemed like this cold that I had was just getting worse. Anyways, the following morning, as you remember, like when we do 24-hour shift, we go home the following day and have like that whole day off, technically. And I remember I went home on like that Thursday and I just like wasn't getting any better. Finally went back to the hospital. And I had this like progressively worsening shortness of breath and cough, and they had done some tests, and basically, like, luckily I had been at the hospital. I don't remember much about what had happened, but I had gotten admitted to do this workup of what exactly was going on with me. And basically, like right after the ER and when I was on the floor, I just kind of crashed. So the last thing I remember from that night was my heart rate going down. I was feeling very sweaty. I wasn't feeling good. And there was like ringing in my ears, and basically I was in shock. So at that time, we didn't know what was going on. I had to get intubated, resuscitated, go to the ICU. And by the time I woke up, I want to say like 24, 48 hours later, that's when they kind of were putting the puzzle pieces together. And they told me that I had like basically what it seemed like was subacute cardiomyopathy, unsure if it was due to a virus or something else. What we eventually figured out was that probably I had this, I eventually found the gene. So I had a genetic predisposition to cardiomyopathy with the desmoplakin gene mutation. And they theorized that probably I had some sort of virus that like worsened whatever predisposition that I already had. But my official diagnosis was familial dilated cardiomyopathy, and I had pretty severe biventricular failure, and my ejection fraction was like 5%. It was bad.
Wow.
The only thing that basically could have been done was to get a heart transplant. So I got transferred eventually to Penn. I was doing my residency in Philadelphia, but I eventually ended up at Penn and then got on the urgent heart transplant list and got a heart transplant. So I went from being like a completely, or you know, pretty normal 30-year-old to like a heart transplant recipient within less than 2 to 3 weeks. It was crazy.
No, it's an unbelievable paradigm shift. I mean, one position, you're fully in control. You're a resident physician. You are diagnosing and treating patients.
Right.
And next minute, you are the patient. So at what point did that dawn on you that your role has just switched?
Yeah, I think people ask me this all the time, and like, there's so much that I don't remember anymore, and I have to like go back and read like how I was feeling. I'm always like, is it because I don't remember because it's like traumatic, or was it because I was like hypoperfusing to my brain? I don't know. But I remember kind of not fully being I was basically like, no, it can't. I was in denial. I was like, this can't be it. Like, I'm probably going to be fine. I've seen plenty of cases of viral myocarditis when, like, you know, you get a couple weeks of milrinone and you get some support and you're fine. I was like, maybe it's that. But I remember, like, at one point, you know, my family was there, my co-residents, my friends, everybody was, like, visiting. And I remember, like, going through the thought process of, like, okay, you know what? Like, let me just come to terms with the fact that I'm a very critically ill patient. I need to get this heart transplant. And I remember even saying like, you know what, let me just get it. Like, let me just get the heart transplant. I'm going to say, yes, let's get it. And let's get out of here. Like, I just came to terms with it. And I remember that's probably the day that I just like gave into my diagnosis and let myself be the patient. And it was a hard switch, but eventually I got there.
Wow. I think those two words are really powerful, gave in to being a patient, because it kind of highlights the experience that you were going through at that time. Now, kind of flash forward to the present, how did that experience affect how you see patients or who may be in similar cases of denial or not understanding the severity of those symptoms? How do you relate your experiences to patients that you can see, hey, you're going through something similar as I went through?
Yeah, I'm actually like quite open with my story with not every patient, but a lot of my own patients, especially like during fellowship where I was at a high volume, you know, advanced heart failure center and lots of transplants happened. So, you know, there were specific patients that I saw myself in, like a lot of patients, it would take, especially like younger patients, right? Like we're the ones that aren't, and when I say younger, like younger than 50, you know, they're the ones who usually aren't used to being in the hospital, having issues and you know, it was, so I see myself in some of those and I'll tell them my story and I told them, I said, you know, I just kind of embraced the uncertainty of the moment and what was happening. And I kind of gave in to everything. And I said, all right, this is what I need to do. No matter how much I'm upset or angry or sad or looking back, should I have gone to the doctor sooner? Should I have done this? Like, it's not going to change the fact that right now I need a heart transplant. And so like, once you get that in your mindset, it almost, in my opinion, makes the process just a little bit easier. Like, you know, it's obviously a very difficult process, but it just makes it a little bit easier. And I think once you come to terms with it, it makes things go a little smoothly sometimes.
It's interesting. You know, embracing uncertainty is something we are all taught in medical school from the very basis of creating that differential diagnosis. But uncertainty is often very difficult for people who may not have that medical training to understand.
Right, yeah.
What do you do to help patients, quote unquote, come to terms? Do you ever find yourself saying, I came to terms, how come you can't come to terms? Or does that never kind of cross your mind?
I think I never judge any, I think everybody has their own kind of, you know, mindset and thought processes. And I don't think mine is necessarily the right way, you know, But in general, I do think that coming to terms, so that's funny that you say it like that, because I think that my training as a doctor is what kind of helped me get through all of this. But there's plenty of doctors I know who say things like, oh my God, if I was in your position, I would have just like stopped being a, like, I would have not continued residency. I would have, and I'm like, no, because in medicine, we're taught all the time, especially like I have emergency medicine, right? Like things can happen in a second and you have to learn how to think on your feet. And I kind of took that training and that the way that I was thinking into what was happening to me, you know, like etiology and questioning and looking back and regretting and doing all this and thinking about this. There's only so much we can contemplate. At the end of the day, this is what's given to me. And it's similar in the ER, like there's a patient who comes in randomly with a stroke or a heart attack, and we have to kind of be okay with it and help manage what's going on in front of us. So I feel like I used my medical training when I was going through all this, and I think it helped me. I'm not saying every doctor needs to go through this or every patient needs to be a doctor to understand, but I do think that in my particular situation, it helped me with my medical training.
And certainly it did. I mean, your bravery and your confidence clearly show not just in how you're presenting yourself, but in a lot of the advocacy that you're doing as well. Yeah. So you have a blog, A Change of Heart.
Yeah.
And very poignantly, you begin with the phrase, I almost died. And then you go through kind of your experiences, both personal, professional. What does the blog do for you? Is it a form of expression or is it also a means of advocacy as well?
Yeah, actually, I haven't updated the blog in such a long time, but the initial reason why I started it was because I was in the hospital and I just kept getting texts. I mean, when I say hundreds of texts and calls a day, like asking about what was going on, and I was like, I'm just going to like write it all out and put it out there. And I thought it would be easier for me to like send everyone just like one link as to what was going on with me. And then I was like, hey, why don't I also just kind of use it to advocate for organ donation? There aren't, in general, it's kind of a stigma for physicians to have disabilities and chronic illness. And so I figured, hey, like my story's already out there. I might as well, you know, jump on the opportunity to use my platform as a physician to advocate for something like organ donation that saved my life. And so at first it started as like a form of expression. And then I was like, let me add in some other things, resources, facts. And then on top of that, it turned into like a way for others to connect with me. So there were so many other younger people or physicians or honestly, anybody, transplant patients would message me or email me through it and they'd say like, oh my God, I connected with your story so well and thank you for writing it. So it became almost like, it was like an all-inclusive blog that I didn't even realize would get big. I just kind of made it for my close friends and family and then it became a bigger deal.
Certainly, it has the presence of being cathartic. So congratulations on kind of expressing your writing it that way. Let's pivot a little bit to the policy angle, because I think that's important, because oftentimes experience makes for the best policy. Mm-hmm. You advocate for organ donation and research. Yet so much misinformation exists even before the kind of misinformation laden world of the pandemic that we find ourselves in. Organ donation in particular is one of those unique fields where people were afraid if I check that I'm an organ donor, I won't receive medical care, or if this happens, that happens. So much misinformation. And I think, unfortunately, it has only gotten worse with recent years. How do you encounter and experience misinformation, one, and then what do you do to address it, two?
Right. This all starts, so like my illness was like the year before COVID, and obviously I feel like misinformation got 100 times worse after COVID, but before that, organ donation, like you said, a lot of people have all these like myths about it. And I realized that telling my story was able to bust so many myths. So like one thing that people would always say, they'd be like, I heard, you know, I don't want to be an organ donor because I heard that doctors will like not save my life. And I'd be like, I'm actually the doctor like that's in the ER. And that is not like, even if there was some rogue doctor out there who was trying to do that, like, what is the benefit? And also, like, we don't even know who's an organ donor. That's why it's a whole, like, there's a whole third party that like comes in and sees, you know, which patients need, you know, are organ donors and have to talk to family. So like, it's not even a possibility for somebody to want to do that. And so just by telling my story and then, you know, having this background as a physician, I was able to use my story and also bust the myths that were out there. And in general, like, I have a degree in public health, and I remember taking a health education course. There's only so much you can tell people. Like, if someone is not willing to come to terms with the fact that, you know, you're telling the correct facts, then there's really no point in like arguing, you know, and that goes for COVID too. So there were so many people who'd be like, you know, I just don't want to get a vaccine. You can engage as much as you want and you can educate as much as you want, but you're never going to be able to force. And so I do the same thing with organ donation. I never force anybody to become an organ donor, but I give them, you know, the answers that in my opinion, you know, whatever questions they have, I try to answer. And hopefully that helps. I think there sometimes some, especially physicians, like a long time ago used to be a little more like patriarchal and like, this is the way we do things. Now it's kind of more of like an open discussion. And I like to view organ donation and misinformation in the same way.
Let's explore that a little bit. And I'm going to ask kind of out of the box question, but I think your perspective would be very important on this. We saw during the pandemic that there are data and facts, and then there are the biases around the data and facts. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those biases overwhelm what is underneath it. In the world of organ donation, what are some common forms of biases that you've seen, and how are they typically manifested? So give an example where you'd see, okay, a patient is presenting with information in this way, it's likely because of this bias. Talk through some of your experiences.
Yeah, I think, just like organ donation in general. So a lot of people will be like, oh, you know, I've heard that, you know, if you're rich, you know, you're going to get an organ faster than if you're not. And like, I have no idea where these like, maybe it's from the media, I don't know, or like movies and stuff, who knows. But the way that I approach something like that, if a patient were to tell me, I say like, okay, like, how did you learn that? And then like, once they say like, you know, it's from this XYZ movie, and I'll say, okay, well, that's not the truth. Actually, UNISTA has this like whole way of listing someone, and it's based on how sick you are and age and like, you know, there's all these things that go into the algorithm. And then they're like, oh, okay. So I think answering whatever questions they have without necessarily like imposing your own like views on things, that's the way to approach any type of misinformation. And I think most of us do a pretty good job on that.
No, nice. Certainly. Before we get too far into the podcast, if you wouldn't mind just dropping a plug for a couple of sites, whether it's online or otherwise, where they could find out actual fact-based information about organ donation.
Yeah, the Donate Life America website, or you can even go to, if you just Google Donate Life America and go to that website. The thing is, every country is different. So, you know, you have to find whichever country you're living in has their own set of facts and rules about organ donation. Even regions sometimes differ. And then if you actually want to register to become an organ donor, it's just registerme.org is how you do it. And even through that website, you can find out more information about organ donation.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. Wanted to make sure that was put in right after I asked the question about misinformation. Now, let's play devil's advocate. Let's say you're talking to a patient and you successfully educate that patient on the misinformation around organ donation. The patient then asks, well, what are some things that need to be fixed about the organ donation process? What would be your answer to that patient?
One of the things that actually needs to be fixed, which is kind of in the process of being fixed right now, this is specifically in America. I can't talk about like other countries and how they do it, but transparency on how organ procurement organizations and OPOs do things. UNIS, which is like the governing body of how organ donation transplantation occurs, who's on the list and all that stuff. You know, over the years, they haven't been very transparent about the process itself, but more and more nowadays, they're trying to become much more open about, what the guidelines are, more policies about the different ways of getting organs allocated to different regions in the country. And so that stuff is being worked on right now. And I have a lot of hope. And hopefully with all these policies, new guidelines, all these new changes that they're slowly making over the next, few years, it'll increase access to organ donation too, and transplantation.
Nice. And I know it's a little bit nuanced, and I know it's a little bit in the weeds to get into this topic, but I think just for those who may be interested in learning more, talk about the lack of transparency in the procurement process and how that has affected people's willingness to be donors.
I can't talk too much about it because I'm not a transplant doctor. I take care of patients, but I've taken care of patients in the transplant ICU, but I've never, I'm not a transplant nephrologist or cardiologist. I'm not on the committees that figure out all those processes, but I do know that it's been a problem over the years. Because there isn't that much control over these OPOs sometimes, some, OPOs do better than others, and they, there's a lot of politics that happens. But hopefully with, within the next few years, once these changes occur, things will happen more smoothly and more transparently.
Certainly. Thank you for that. Let's transition to a couple of questions that I think you might find fun because they'll be a little more personal in nature.
Yeah.
So you're both a patient and a doctor, mm-hmm. and the two can at times seem complete opposites of one another. Talk about a situation in which you are either treating a patient or just on rounds in general, and you kind of switched from being both a patient and a physician going back and forth.
Yeah.
And you started having these cognitive shifts.
Yeah, there's been like a lot of interesting times, especially during fellowship. I always tell like my co-fellows and my colleagues to ask me any questions they have. Like I've had every procedure done to me. Again, I was a critically ill patient and I'm currently like an ICU doctor. So not only have I experienced most of those procedures, including chest tubes, intubations, like all those things, but I also like know how to do many of them. And so like notoriously all my co-fellows would know during fellowship, like I'd be like, yeah, this and this, if you're going to be doing a chest tube, make sure to remember to give like a longer acting type of anesthetic that'll, numb the area, because once the chest tube is actually in, although the lidocaine is wearing off, there's still pain, in that area that you have to think about, or just, be generous with the pain medication. So there's like little things like that that always help. One of my like favorite stories during fellowship was one time, like we were about to extubate somebody and I went in the room and the guy just like was staring at me and he was awake because we were about to extubate him, but he kept like pointing to his mouth. And then my attending was like looking at me and I'm like, he's really thirsty. And he's like, how do you know? And I'm like, oh, trust me, I've been there. I know exactly what he's saying and what he needs right now. Let's just get this tube out and, make sure he's okay to swallow because his mouth is really dry. And so I almost feel like there's like endearing stories like that where, again, I never say I think every doctor should go through some crazy critical illness, but I do think it gives me like this different perspective. That's kind of nice for patients to know that like, hey, I've been through it too. And, I turned out okay. So.
Yeah. I mean, when you go back to the foundations of American medicine with Sir William Osler and other physicians like that, they always talked about the experience of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like your experience gives you a sixth sense almost where you can kind of. You can kind of sense things that maybe you would not have been able to otherwise, or at least pick up on as immediately.
Yeah. And that's kind of the way that I see it too, because like, this sounds kind of weird and I never know how to like express it in the best way, but it's almost like, having been through this, the way that I justified it all was like, it's kind of a blessing to know what my own patients are going through, because not every doctor could always say that.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily make me better, but it's just this like extra thing that I can bring to the table when I'm taking care of people.
Nice. And kind of going along with that, the whole patient-physician paradigm, there's also another thing, and that's you as a person that is outside of the healthcare realm. When you were going through all of this, and even now, do you ever find it difficult to just separate yourself from everything and just be who you are? Or do you have some means of kind of just finding your own personal identity?
Yeah, I'm pretty, you know, over the years, especially because my story got big. And so like a lot of people always want to like, for example, do interviews or podcasts or lectures. And in the beginning, I kind of said yes to everything. And then I realized one of the ways to like, help me keep be a little sane is to, you know, have boundaries and be okay with saying no to certain things, or at least, you know, because I'm busy, you know, working and trying to have a personal life, I try to keep more of the advocacy stuff just to like a few things a month so that it doesn't always, you know, become my life. And so in the meantime, like in between, you know, me working and doing all my advocacy work and doing all these like amazing fun things, I do find it fun. I try to keep sane by doing other things like traveling. And then, you know, when I am traveling, I try to just like not do any sort of work or anything, no social media, nothing. And so I try to be really good about compartmentalization and setting up boundaries so that I still have like a piece of just me, you know, not the doctor, not the patient, just me. Yeah. And I'm pretty boring in general. So like, I don't have much, but it's fine.
Boring is a good thing, trust me. So on that note, let's talk about your podcast, Both Sides of the Stethoscope. How long has that been going on, and what are some of the topics that you like to discuss?
Yeah, that's actually really cool. So when I first got the transplant, I met a lot of people around my age or physicians, you know, who had also had transplants. Kobe Salerno messaged me on social media, and he and I are very good friends now, but this was years ago. And he was like, hey, by the way, like I am, he, at that time, he was an internal medicine resident. I was an ER resident, but the only difference between me and him, he also had a heart transplant, but he had chronic, he had hokum and chronic health issues kind of his whole life. And so he got a transplant before med school and was kind of navigating training and schooling with a transplant. And then I was on the opposite end where like, you know, everything had been fine. And then towards the end of my training, I got a transplant from like acute health issues. So we had different views, but at the same time helped each other a lot. And wow. So he was like a blessing, because he was like, yeah, if you have any questions, like, let me know. And I'd be like, oh, so do you wear this was before COVID, like, do you wear an N95 with all patients? Like, we would just like talk about how we deal with our transplant in the healthcare setting. So we became friends like throughout the years. And then, you know, last year he was like, I have always wanted to do some sort of podcast about, you know, what I've been through. Why don't we do it together? Cause we're both, now he's a cardiology fellow, which is awesome. At that time I was a critical care fellow. And so we started the podcast kind of, you know, not to give medical advice, but just to kind of give our positions on specific things, how we navigated the world of COVID. We bring in guests who have heart transplants or other types of transplants. We do episodes about, you know, myths about organ donation. Sometimes we actually have like an Instagram, and so sometimes like people will ask us things and we'll do whole podcast episodes with those questions. We're about to restart recording our next season. But so far it's been really fun. And it's just like something we do on the side, you know, we're not like trying to make we don't make money off of it or anything. It's just like a fun way to kind of express ourselves and hope that it helps. So it's called Both Sides of the Stethoscope, and it's on basically every podcast platform.
Awesome. Yeah. And for those who are listening via the podcast on Daily Remedy, there will be a link to that podcast at the bottom, just below the screen.
Thank you. Yeah.
One last question before I let you go.
Sure.
Given so much attention in a positive way has been garnered to your story, and in many ways you've been extremely accessible and just passionate about sharing your story, but I have to imagine at some point it felt a little bit overwhelming, which you kind of alluded to in that you're scaling back a little bit. How do you make the decision to engage in a certain activity or a certain platform versus kind of just recognizing this is my limit.
Yeah, I kind of just go with how I'm feeling. You know, obviously there's days where I'm feeling great and I'm able to do a lot more than other days. And that goes for most humans in general. And yeah, just like because of my heart transplant. And I try to, like, obviously, for example, when I was in fellowship, one of my things was once I'm done with fellowship, I wanted to take a few months off, which is what I'm doing right now. So like my next job starts next month, but this whole time, the last like 5 months, I've just kind of taken time off just to relax and recharge my batteries. And so I'm really good about setting time aside for things that are, once I feel overwhelmed, I'm okay with saying like, hey, I'm overwhelmed, I'm going to set this aside. I'm okay with canceling this. I'm okay with that. And I think overall, everybody's been really good about that. That's the reason why I only try to do a few, let's say, interviews per month. I try not to do them during months that I'm extra busy with work. So like, I try to scale it and have a feel for it myself. I don't have like specific rules and guidelines on things. That's kind of the way that I've done it. Obviously it took a couple of years of me doing them until I figured out what was the best, strategy for me, but it was just kind of like how I feel. And, you know, during that week and I go with that.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join Daily Remedy in our podcast. For those who have made it to the end of the podcast, please note that there will be a link to Dr. Grossian's blog and to our podcast. And if you're interested in learning more, can you tell the audience how they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can either just follow me on social media is probably the easiest way. So my social media accounts, the main one that I use is Instagram, and that's just a Change of Heart blog with underscores after each word. And then you can also find me on Twitter. So AG_EM33 is my Twitter handle. And that's the best way to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. And you have an amazing story.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.